Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, the podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Little Dancer, aged 14, 1878-1881, Edgar Degas' groundbreaking statuette of a young ballerina that caused a sensation at the 1881 Impressionist exhibition, takes center stage in a National Gallery of Art exhibition titled Degas' Little Dancer. On view from October 5, 2014 to February 8, 2015, the exhibition explores Degas' fascination with ballet and his experimental modern approach to his work. It is presented in conjunction with the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts world premiere musical, Little Dancer. In this paired lecture recorded on November 16, 2014, Degas specialists Richard Kendall and Jill Devonyar examine Little Dancer, age 14, by focusing on the relationship between this avant-garde work and its model, Marie van Gorthum. Kendall discusses the sculpture's revolutionary realism, and Devonyar analyzes its radicalism as an image of the ballet. Kendall and Devonyar share fresh insight into the artist's world, his innovative techniques, and his deep knowledge of the ballet.
It's a great pleasure to be here, as always, and a great pleasure to be talking about this subject. Jill and I have seen, two nights ago, we saw the production at the Kennedy Center about The Little Dancer. As a matter of interest, how many of you have seen it? Okay, all right. Well, all I'm going to say is I think our view, which you may or may not agree with, was that it was extremely good entertainment, a very, very professional production. On the matter of history, not so much. Some of it's pretty good, but there are some significant, gaps, which a production is allowed to do on a stage. They're not historians. But one of the things we hope to do is to sort of refocus on The Little Dancer, age 14, which, of course, lives here, and to talk a little bit more very explicitly about that sculpture, how Degas made it, why he made it the way he did, and something about the model, Marie van Gorthum, who is now part of history. Central to both presentations from myself and Jill is our belief that Degas is among the most radical artists of the modern age. Not everybody thinks of him as a major radical. This is based not just on his work in several media, which includes drawing, painting, pastel, printmaking, sculpture, and photography, but also his bold, modernist subject matter and his revolutionary rethinking of the art-making process. Here you see him, the young Degas in the 1860s when he was a complete nobody. He was around 30 years old and unknown in the Paris art world. He looked shy, rather formal, hardly like an artist at all. But by this date, Degas had already been working hard at his profession for more than a decade, refining his drawing skills and thinking deeply about contemporary art. Don't forget, he was a cutting-edge kid making modern art. Increasingly, he would also mix with some of the most challenging talents in the city, Manet and Whistler, for example, and soon with the group we now know as the Impressionists. He was also reading widely the poems of Charles Baudelaire, the novels of Émile Zola, and of Edmond Duranty. It's wonderful to see this on a huge scale. This is a sketchbook about this big, hugely enlarged. It's a sketchbook he used in the early 1870s. Even at first glance, this drawing tells us a lot about the direction that Degas and his art are moving. Here he's recording a distinctly contemporary subject, a theatre in modern Paris, specifically the stage of the opera, and approaching it in a fresh, dynamic manner. Notice the ballerina quickly sketched at lower right. Can you see her? And also the row of outlined double bass heads in the foreground. Notice that he also wrote on his drawing, recording the brilliant effects of the white shirts of audience members in the theatrical gloom. He writes, chemise éclatant, just there. And the vividness of the shadows, noir vif, in the overall effect. This was the kind of painting that Degas had begun to produce in the new decade. It's called The Rehearsal of a Ballet on Stage of about 1874. It's in the Musée d'Orsay. It's an unusual work painted in monochrome, related to a magazine illustration that he was planning, when its bold contrast of light and shade would have been starkly effective. Some of the notes that Degas made in his sketchbook have clearly borne fruit. The stark white costumes of the dancers and the deep shadows of the theatre add to the drama of the stage production itself. By this date, Degas was already attracting attention to himself in avant-garde circles, as he painted the life of Paris in bold, confrontational ways. He showed this very canvas at the historic First Impressionist exhibition in 1874 in Paris. Some critics admired it for its, quote, finely observed effects of light and dark and its, quote, precise drawing. But this picture also angered some other critics. One called it very strange, and another went so far as to suggest that such works resulted from mental alienation. Bizarre though these remarks seem today, they remind us that pictures such as Ballet Rehearsal on Stage seemed shocking, even threatening to many of Degas' contemporaries. This was partly due to their, quote, vulgar subject matter and partly to their challenging approaches to representing the modern world. Degas' own ambitions are hinted at in a now famous essay written by his friend Duranty, and entitled The New Painting. It's generally thought that Degas might have had a hand in this. Duranty argued that this new painting should engage directly with the energy of city life, including the, quote, movement and hustle and bustle of passers-by. He also advocated, quote again, a new method of colour, of drawing, and a gamut of original points of view. Remember that. Sometimes our viewpoint is very high, sometimes very low, he pointed out. In Degas' painting, you're seeing, he's clearly chosen to investigate a gamut of original points of view. Here he adopted for a dramatically high viewpoint, as if he himself was peering down on the stage from above. In other works, Degas' pictures seem to show him looking upwards, towards figures in a theatre box or a performer in the circus. These unusual vantage points allowed him to energise the viewer's visual experience, relationship with the subject, and capture some of the vitality of modern urban experience. A second insight into Degas' new strategies can again be found in the notebooks, especially one used around 1876. Scribbling down several pages of ideas for new pictures, he imagined, his imagination was bubbling away, I think. He imagined doing a series of portraits of women seen from above, others seen from below, sitting very close to a woman and looking up at her. He then continued with some quite new ideas. He thought of drawing a profile that wouldn't move, moving myself, going up or down for the same figure. Here he seems to be grappling with the idea on this picture on the screen, the idea of moving in relation to his model, with the model remaining stationary while he changed his angle of view. This is pretty radical stuff for the 1870s by any standards. In other drawings that survive from this period, Degas seems to have put some of these ideas into action. Many of them represent ballerinas, as in this example of study of legs. Here we naturally assume that all the drawings on the sheet relate to a single dancer, whose legs Degas has drawn multiple times in a variety of different positions. These studies also appear to imply slightly different angles of view. In the pair in the lower left foreground, for example, the artist seems to have been looking downwards at close quarters. In the study at upper centre, by contrast, he was apparently at the same level as his model. It's a modest case, but Degas does seem to have been here following his own advice. moving myself, going up or down, the same for a whole figure. In several other drawings, you'll have spotted the link with the little dancer. These are all connected in some way with that project. In several other drawings from this group of ballerina studies, such as five studies for a pair of legs on the screen, something even more complicated is happening. A further note in Degas' sketchbook seems to explain what this is. He says, "Draw a series of arm movements of the dance," he told himself, "or of legs that wouldn't move, turning around them oneself." If we analyse the legs in this drawing, you'll realise that Degas has done exactly what he proposed. In each separate study, the two legs remain fixed in a single configuration relative to each other, in a pose that dancers today call a casual fourth position. What Degas has done is to draw this same position from several angles, either by instructing his model to rotate a few degrees every time he finished a study, or, as he had proposed in his own notebook, turning around them oneself. No longer would he be simply looking up or down, but actually moving bodily around the dancer while she remains still. In Degas' case, his experiments with moving around the model to create fresh and challenging viewpoints were clearly part of a larger creative project. But their significance surely goes even closer. By, in effect, becoming a mobile viewer, he not only extended his options in the studio, but also linked his art-making with life in the wider world. Mobile viewing is what we are all engaged with in our everyday lives as we walk through rooms and along streets and look around us at a world in flux. You were all doing mobile viewing when you came to the gallery and as you walked around the galleries. In this sense, Degas was proposing a way of making art that was directly expressive of the energy of modern life. Put simply, he replaced the static visual relationships of the past with something like the hustle and bustle of city existence cited by Duranty in 1876. Well, here she is. This is the wax version of the sculpture, the original work that Degas made in the late 1870s, early 1880s, which is what all the fuss is about. Degas embarked on this sculpture project in the late 1870s, a project that would define much of his early professional career, the little dancer, age 14. Here we're seeing the original wax, as I've said. The project of making this figure was remarkable in many ways, not least the fact that Degas had no training as a sculptor. In addition, Degas had clearly decided to create a three-dimensional dancer figure of a profoundly innovative kind. The figure was to be approximately two-thirds life size, around a metre high, and would remain by far the largest sculpture he ever attempted. It would also be dressed, a sculpture that was dressed in clothing, in garments made of real fabric, with a hair wig on its head and miniature shoes, real shoes, on its feet. For any sculptor at this period, this would have been a severe technical challenge. For Degas, it clearly stretched his limits, his abilities to their limits, and may have brought him close to failure. There's a lot of evidence in it that he struggled. But it's also clear that the idea stimulated his creative imagination to an extraordinary degree and allowed him to put into action his thinking about radical methods of representation, but now in sculptural form. And I have to say, if I have one serious criticism of the Kennedy Center production, it's the handling of the making of the sculpture, which is horrible. It looks as if he threw it together in a casual fashion, where it's quite clear to anybody who thinks about it that it must have taken months of painstaking work. So here we see an X-ray made by the conservation staff here in this building, which reveals more completely than any previous studies how Degas actually created his sculpture. We can clearly see the metal armature that supports the body, which registers as three white vertical elements with two horizontal pieces across the hips and back. So this is the metal structure that holds it all together, going right up to her head. So far, so good. That's what a proper sculptor would have done. This structure was probably made by a professional of some kind under Degas' guidance, and it looks impressive until we start considering some other details. The horizontal element across the back, for example, is not strongly attached to the vertical spine-like structure, and neither is the dancer's head supported by the armature. So there should be a connection between this metal rod and the head, but it stops there. So there's no reason in principle why somebody shouldn't just break it off. Looking more closely at the X-ray, we can also see rather wild clusters of thin white lines, which correspond to various kinds of wire used by Degas to support the mass of the arms, legs, neck, and torso. So we're talking about this clusters of wire to sort of bulk the sculpture out. All this suggests an element of improvisation, to put it politely, if not downright incompetence, which reminds us that Degas was still a beginner in the world of sculpture. When he planned to make the little dancer at age 14, Degas must have been aware that these formidable technical obstacles lay ahead. But there were also other kinds of challenges that we might describe as conceptual. How should he set about studying his model with the making of a sculpture in mind? How would he familiarize himself with a young girl's distinctive, slim, prepubescent body? And how would he begin to articulate it as a series of forms in three-dimensional space? That leap from the two-dimensional to the three-dimensional had to be tackled. True to character, Degas seems to have relied heavily on direct patient observation and on an obsessive campaign of drawing. Having hired as his model a young trainee dancer from the Paris Opera Company, Marie van Gertem, he began to draw her both thoughtfully and relentlessly. Degas made at least 9 separate sheets of drawings of his model, including this exquisite example that belongs to a private collector in Europe. Following established practice, he apparently began by drawing Marie in the nude. Notice how the essential pose of the final sculpture has already been determined. The model's right leg projects forward, her arms are clasped behind her back, and her head is tilted slightly upwards. So he had the pose. He just needed to work out how to get it into sculpture. In this drawing, again, notice that he's represented the model from 3 viewpoints, back, front, and side. It's conceivable that all 3 studies were accomplished in a single session, though equally plausible that Marie returned to his studio until Degas had finished the trio. At a certain point, he made at least 1 other drawing of Marie in the nude, showing a 3/4 view, and also went on to make a wax sculpture of the naked figure on a smaller scale than the finished little dancer. You can see the nude study, if you want to, as you go out, if you make a couple of turns. I always get lost in this museum. The next stage may well be represented by this drawing. Now working with the final clothed sculpture in mind, Degas drew Marie's head and upper body in great detail. Notice the attention he directed at her head, face and hair, but also at the rather unusual position of the arms. So look, he's really made a point of studying her expression, the distinctive character of her hair and her features, the way the hair comes down the back and so forth. Why did he need to draw these features again when he surely had recorded them, he'd already recorded them in the previous sheet? The answer again is surely that Degas realized how spatially and anatomically complex these forms were, and how they were also contrary to normal, i.e. non-balletic behavior. Such drawing is partly about looking at what is in front of the artist and recording it, but also about understanding what the artist sees in order to represent it in three dimensions. It was presumably for these same reasons that Degas decided to make this sheet that, of drawings that I've already shown you. It's now clear that it represents Marie's legs, and she held the position that Degas had chosen for her. But it's also evident that these drawings do not represent positions that were randomly created and casually arranged on Degas' sheet of paper. Now you have to concentrate. At top left, we see Marie's legs from behind. At top right, we see them after she is apparently turned through 90 degrees in a clockwise direction, here showing us her right side. Beneath that drawing, we again see her sideways, this time showing us her left side. And in the lowest drawing, Marie seems to have turned back once more so that we now see her from the back. So if you follow around... Oh, no, sorry, didn't mean to do that. That's even worse. There we go. You have to imagine her slowly turning around and then until she gets back to her original position. These five drawings, in other words, appear to follow a logical sequence in which Degas has documented the dancer's body in a relatively systematic way. How did he do this? There are basically two options again. The first is that he remained still while the dancer turned slightly after each pose and readopted exactly the same pose for the next drawing and so on. The second option takes us back to an earlier point in my talk when I referred to Degas' note in his sketchbook about making drawings of legs that wouldn't move turning around oneself. In this scenario, Marie would have stayed still throughout the making of these drawings while Degas moved around her and adopted a different viewpoint for each drawn study. In a way, it sounds obvious what I'm telling you, but nobody else had ever worked this out before Jill and I presented at the Royal Academy about 5 or 6 years ago. And once you see it, it's really kind of stunningly obvious, but it is a fascinating feature of these things. Degas, in other words, became a mobile viewer, a roving eye that settled at a series of calculated positions in order to fully comprehend his subject in three dimensions. If this idea still seems far-fetched to some of you, I can offer a lot more evidence. This superb sheet from the Art Institute of Chicago is one of the most vivid of all the surviving drawings of the little dancer, age 14. Now we see the full figure of the young ballerina and the details of her costume, here shown from three variations on a frontal position. In this drawing, it becomes vividly apparent how Degas surveyed his model from multiple angles. The pose clearly remains exactly the same, but the angle from which he viewed Marie changes significantly. Degas was not poor, but even he could not expect to pay Marie to pose for him throughout the entire modelling process. Don't forget, she was a working ballerina at this time. She had to go to daily rehearsals and so on, and classes. In her absence, he would be obliged to consult his own set of drawings and work on the many complex spatial and technical challenges he had chosen to tackle. At left is another drawing of this kind. This one's from the Morgan Library in New York. At right, a study from a private collection. A few strokes of pastel have been added to both sheets to give them more life, but otherwise they're relatively unfinished by Degas' standards. They are what artists call working drawings, in other words, principally made to help him with a sculptural challenge. Seen side by side, these two drawings again seem to conform to the idea in Degas' notebook that he should draw a series of arm movements of the dance, of legs that wouldn't move, turning around them oneself. Presented together, the progression of poses represented in these drawings certainly suggests a stationary model with an artist turning around her, drawing as he goes. Or again, the opposite, the artist fixed in one place with the model slightly modifying her position under his direction as he advanced from drawing to drawing. Now, this is not a painting by Degas. It's one by somebody you knew quite well, Jean-Léon Jérôme, a more academic artist. It's called Working in Marble, and it was painted in 1890, long after the little dancer had been made. A device that combines both approaches that I've mentioned in is a large-scale rotating platform on which a model could be positioned and rotated at will. These were quite common in artist studios. Here we see one of them in the studio of Jérôme, who, as I've mentioned, was a friend. Jérôme is rather illogically standing on the turntable himself, along with his model, and therefore making a complete nonsense of the piece of equipment. But you can see the point that to make that sculpture, the marble sculpture, he posed that model, the living model there, and would have turned it around as he turned around his sculpture. Now I've lost my place. There is no evidence that Degas himself owned such a device on this scale, but neither is there evidence against it. We know that he later had a rotating turntable of some kind for making smaller waxes and of nudes and dancers. To make this point clearer, here is a rearranged diagram of the individual studies made by using copies of the drawings and cutting them up so that each separate figure drawing could be placed in a variety of alternate sequences. I have to tell you, the first time that Jill and I did this, we literally used photocopies, cut them out and arranged them on our kitchen table. And when we did this and it all fell together, it was actually a thrilling moment. You realize how systematic Degas had been, something that nobody had noticed before. So here you're seeing most of the drawings of the clothed dancer that I've already shown you, now cut from the original sheets. Suddenly, Degas' rather haphazard sheets of drawings made a different kind of sense. As we move from drawing to drawing in this revised sequence, Marie van Gertem seems to shift through approximately 45 degrees from one individual study to the next. The progression is not exact or comprehensive, but the three-dimensional account of Degas' model comes much closer to completion. If this hypothesis is correct, it seems to correspond remarkably closely to the idea that Degas wrote in his notebook around the time he began The Little Dancer. Degas himself did indeed draw a series of legs that wouldn't move, turning around them oneself, except that here he went further, drawing the entire dancer. Whether it was him who rotated about Marie or vice versa, the result was effectively the same, a set of drawings that encompassed a highly complex three-dimensional form. Much like a laser scanner in our own times, which rotates an object in front of the scanning mechanism, Degas' drawings recorded detailed, comprehensive information about a three-dimensional form, allowing it to be reproduced in another material on another scale. In principle, he could have done a tiny one, he could have done a life-size one, he could have done one 20 feet high, just using this information. And this is Jill's masterpiece, where she stuck them all, we put them all together on a computer. Every single study I've shown you, pretty much, showing how systematic Degas was as he worked around the, not of course the sculpture, but of course Marie herself. As you can see, these individual figures have been placed around an image of the sculpture. The result is something like an aerial view of Degas' studio when Marie van Gertem was posing for him. The drawings are arranged to correspond with the view of his model that Degas would have had. Seen in this way, Degas' approach to making his sculpture seems more radical than ever. So to return to the point I made at the beginning of my talk, this diagram also seems to map out the dynamic nature of the artist's relationship with the model and ultimately with his sculpture. If Marie stayed still, it was the artist who became active. If Degas remained stationary, it was Marie who took on something of that, quote, movement and hustle and bustle that Durante wrote about and saw as the defining quality of their age. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's a great pleasure to be here today. And before I begin my part of the lecture, I want to thank the National Gallery for inviting us, and I would like to single out Faya Kazi and Sarah Battle for making us feel so welcome. Unlike Richard, my contribution to this lecture is informed by direct experience of the ballet world. After training as a classical dancer when I was young, I taught ballet for many years, even while pursuing a career in art history. Consequently, my approach to Degas dance works is inflected by familiarity with classical dance practice, as well as by my subsequent study of 19th century dance history. As you have seen, Degas' drawings of Marie van Gerten represent an unusually dynamic relationship between the artist and his model. When all of his studies of her are mapped out, as in this diagram, it is easy to imagine Degas circling Marie and drawing her, and then changing directions and drawing her again and again from multiple points of view. The mobility of the artist in this endeavor can be seen as part of a larger and equally mobile survey of the dancer's life, one that took Degas into the wings, corridors, and stalls at the Paris Opera, and perhaps most important, into its classrooms. It was in these spaces that Degas observed ballerinas practicing, and this was how he became so familiar with classical dance training and technique. By examining Degas' pictures of the mundane occupations of dancers, I hope to demonstrate the depth of his knowledge of the dance and how it informed the radicalism of the little dancer. First, I'd like to draw your attention to the conspicuously static pose represented in all of the drawings of the little dancer and ultimately in the finished sculpture. Both of the figure's feet are planted firmly on the ground. Both arms are held close to the body, and her lithe torso is completely erect. Though the girl's apparent inertia may suggest idleness, an analysis of her posture and gestures will reveal that Marie was performing an upper body exercise when she modeled for Degas. Unlike steps such as plié, rond de jambe, and battement, this maneuver was not a formal part of a ballet lesson, but one of numerous unofficial exercises that were integrated into a dancer's training. Both casual and stationary, the pose is significant for several reasons. First, it provides insight into the intimate nature of Degas' engagement with the dance. Second, it sheds light on the heated controversy that surrounded the little dancer when it was first exhibited in 1881. Third, it reflects the comprehensive nature of Degas' approach to the dance in general. Before proceeding, it would be helpful to situate the little dancer in the broader context of Degas' dance imagery. His decades-long fascination with the ballet began in the early 1870s, when his attention was first drawn to ballerinas and their everyday routines. Their prevalence in his dance work soon brought him acclaim as the painter of dancers, a reputation that persisted as increasing numbers of ballet scenes emerged from his studio. By the end of the decade, when The Little Dancer was conceived, Degas had already made hundreds of pictures of ballerinas and had clearly become well acquainted with every aspect of their professional lives. A self-proclaimed realist, Degas himself indicated that protracted and patient study of his subjects was paramount to his artistic project. This is a quote. "One should not do Parisian art and Louisiana art indiscriminately," he wrote while visiting his family in New Orleans. "Nothing but a really long stay can reveal the customs of a people, that is to say, their charm." Contemporary accounts attest to Degas' efforts to familiarize himself with the finer details of the dancer's training and with a range of behind-the-scenes activities associated with their art. According to the journalist critic François Thiebaud-Cisson, Degas could often be observed at the Paris Opera with a drawing pad on his knees. "He comes here in the morning," so a companion told him. "He watches all the exercise in which the movements are analyzed, and nothing in the most complicated steps escapes his gaze." Though Thiebaud-Cisson's account does not place Degas on the opera premises at the Paris Opera at any specific date, his early intimacy with the daily activities of ballerinas can be established by examining some of his classroom pictures. Both paintings on the screen now, for example, were begun in the early to mid-1870s, and both represent practice spaces at the opera in the opera building complex. The remarkable scene at left, which belongs to the Fogg Art Museum, features a rather dingy ground-level room that looks out onto a courtyard with shrubbery. And that might not... Oops! Wait. Oh, my goodness. What am I doing? Here it is. You see the shrubbery right there? We've even seen that in photographs of the Paris Opera. Now let me find my spot. Oh, here we go. At right is a painting from the Metropolitan Museum in New York, and it features a grand interior on an upper story with a view of Paris rooftops that can be glimpsed in the reflection of a mirror, which I will endeavor to point to without getting lost. Can you see it right there? That's a mirror, and it's reflecting the window on the opposite side of the room where you could see the roofs. While the principal figures in these two works are executing formal ballet steps, a battement à la seconde in the Fogg picture and a piqué arabesque in the Metropolitan canvas, their off-duty colleagues are shown doing things that dancers do when they are at ease, stretching at the bar, fiddling with their attire, and watching their classmates practice. At this date, Degas made a concerted effort to study informal exercises that ballerinas only performed when out of the public eye. As seen in the detail from the Metropolitan Museum canvas, for example, a dark-haired student in the foreground unconsciously sits with both legs splayed. And she's right there. Though her pose may seem immodest to the uninitiated, those acquainted with ballet will recognize the action as a stretch for the inner thighs. A slightly different stretch employed to a similar end is adopted by the dancer wearing a red shawl in the dance class, the picture at right, which has recently come to the National Gallery from the Corcoran Collection. Seated on a bench, this young woman offhandedly stretches her inner thigh muscles by sitting with her legs turned out to the side. Like the stance adopted by Marie von Gerten for the little dancer, both of these casual exercises could only have been witnessed by Degas in classroom settings, which were rarely accessible to outsiders and only under certain special circumstances. God, I'm not doing very well with this. Okay. The ballerina in the drawing at right reappears in the distance of the Metropolitan canvas, as you could see in the detail at left. So the ballerina I pointed out earlier, here, Degas did a drawing of her. In Degas' finely rendered study, which also belongs to the Metropolitan Museum, a seated ballerina makes further use of some downtime by multitasking. She's not only stretching her inner thigh muscles, but also marking a series of steps with her fingers. Handed down through the generations, this mnemonic device was still used by students and professionals of my own generation. And I asked this yesterday. I showed this picture yesterday. Are there any dancers in the audience who recognize this little mnemonic device? No former dancers or... You do? Okay. Because what dancers used to do, I don't know if they still do, but you would use your fingers to try to remember a combination. So you go, lissajite, this, you know, each finger would represent a leg and a foot, and that was how you tried to remember a combination. When I first encountered this drawing, I was both delighted and surprised. I had no idea that 19th century ballerinas marked steps with their fingers. Oh, I keep using the pointer instead of the advance button. As scores of Degas pictures reveal, numerous informal exercises practiced today were already part of the vernacular ballet vocabulary 140 years ago. Among these is the butterfly position represented in these two pictures. In Degas' charcoal study at left, we find a relaxed version of this stretch, and in the modern photograph at right, featuring a male dancer from the Royal Ballet, we find a more earnest and effective variant. This exercise, like those previously shown, is used to lengthen and warm up the inner thigh muscles that are so essential to ballet technique. These muscles, commonly referred to as turnout muscles, will be discussed shortly. But first, I'd like to convey how important such drawings are to the history of classical dance. Made around 1880, the sheet at left features one of Degas' ballerina models engaged in yet another informal exercise. Known as an attitude stretch, this same maneuver is shown in the photograph at right, where a modern-day student from the Kirov School appears fully costumed, warming up for a performance. Once again, Degas captured a mundane moment in a dancer's daily routine. And once again, he provides an inside glimpse into the ballet training that few of his contemporaries were privy to. In Degas' era, access to the Paris Opera classrooms was highly restricted. Even wealthy subscribers, called abonnés, were not free to wander this territory, though they could visit the foyer and the theater backstage before, during, and after performances. And that's why you sometimes see men roaming around behind the scenery, even peeking out a little bit. You look closely at his pictures, and you'll find them in a lot of places. Degas himself secured these privileges when he became an abonné in 1885. But entree to the classrooms would still have had to be cleared with the proper authorities. Earlier on, this was presumably arranged by one of several close friends with connections to the opera, including the writer-librettist Ludovic Halévy, the opera aficionado Ludovic Lepic, and the orchestra bassoonist Désiré Dio. But by 1886, the artist himself had become familiar enough with the opera's director to write, and this was in 1886, "You have favored me so exceptionally that I am getting to be, as they say, one of the household." Though Degas' admittance to the opera's practice spaces was unusual, he was certainly not the first artist to witness a ballet lesson. What distinguishes his representations of classroom activities is his unprecedented candor, his scrupulous attention to detail, and his desire to survey all aspects of the dance profession, ranging from the tedious routine exercises to spectacular feats on stage. I have focused on the former today mainly because the position represented in The Little Dancer is one of these tedious exercises, and also because Degas' rovings at the Paris Opera yielded one of the most comprehensive compendiums of 19th century ballet practice to come down to us. In numerous instances, in drawings and paintings, they are our only records, textual or visual, of informal exercises that were handed down through the generations by the dancers themselves. Because of the casual nature, these exercises were not illustrated or discussed in technique manuals, nor were they depicted by Degas' predecessors or peers. When seen in this light, the artist's dance oeuvre in general, and the little dancer in particular, assume a dance historical importance that was much overlooked in the past. And as an aside, I have to say I gave a lecture at the Society for Dance Historians, and it was really thrilling because they had never realized how much information about 19th century ballet technique Degas' drawings of dancers contained. It really is remarkable. Richard mentioned earlier that the stance adopted by Marie is called a casual fourth. But what exactly does that mean? The few dancers who are in the audience will know what that means. For those of you who aren't conversant in ballet terminology, I'll explain. There are five primary positions upon which classical technique is based. All of them are illustrated in the diagram at the bottom of the screen, and you'll find fourth position directly below an image of the little dancer. Though the alignment of the legs varies with each of the five primary positions, the feet are always placed along parallel axes with the legs, knees, and feet facing sideways rather than front. Called turnout, this disposition of the lower legs is achieved by rotating the legs outwards from the hip sockets. One of the most distinctive features of classical dancing, turnout is indispensable to the execution of all ballet steps and has been since the 1820s when the dance master Carlo Blasi first codified the technique. In the illustration, the five standard positions are rendered in a diagrammatic fashion, showing perfectly turned out legs. This ideal, which all dancers strive for, requires great flexibility in the hips. Aspiring dancers born with this kind of flexibility have an advantage over those who are not, but sometimes it can be developed through training. Those who are able to achieve full rotation are said to have perfect or 180-degree turnout. If we return to the little dancer in light of this information, we discover that her stance closely resembles fourth position, but her feet and legs are not perfectly turned out. Her position is remote enough from a true fourth that we can categorically say that Degas' model was not attempting a formal position at all. She is depicted in what is commonly referred to as a relaxed or casual fourth, a stance which ballerinas often assume when they are at ease. Similarly posed figures can be found in many dance works by Degas, including this wonderful pastel study currently on view here at the museum. Entitled Dancer Seen from Behind and Three Studies of Feet, this drawing reinforces several points I've already made. At left, Degas has focused on yet another informal balletic action. This one's kind of fun. The stretching of an arch or the breaking in of a shoe. A dancer often does that, bends their shoes like that to break them in. While the studies at right show a pair of legs placed in a casual fourth. Degas' characteristic attention to detail is evident in the rendering of the left figure's upper back, in this description of all the shapely legs shown, and in one case, the way in which a foot conforms to a ballet slipper. I like to point... Ooh, God, it's terrible. This is kind of amusing because this girl's shoe looks really too tight for her, and she can't, like, spread her toes out, and her slipper looks really squished. Now I'd like to demonstrate just how prevalent casual fourth positions are. The casual fourth, like that shown here. As you can see in this photograph from the New York Times, classical dancers are still very prone to this stance. It seems to come with the territory. These students from the School of American Ballet are watching a coach demonstrate some steps, and notably, all of them are standing in a relaxed fourth position. Now, I found this photograph in a newspaper because I didn't want to use a photograph I took because people might think, oh, she just had everybody standing around that way. So I took a picture from a newspaper. The pose approximates its formal counterpart in that the legs are somewhat turned out, but it is not a disciplined or technically correct position. If a dancer were to assume a formal fourth, the legs would be equally and fully rotated. One foot would be parallel directly in front of the other, and the body weight would be evenly distributed over both legs. Hopefully I'll get this right. As we've just established, neither the little dancer nor the students in the New York Times photograph are standing in a working position. In all cases, the turnout is only casually maintained, and most of the body weight is borne on the back leg. This is relevant to the way Degas' sculpture was perceived when it was first exhibited, but I shall return to this a little bit later. At this point, I'd like to attend to the position of the little dancer's arms and compare it to the relatively pedestrian orientation of the student's limbs in the photograph. As you could see, Degas' model was holding her arms in a manner that was not nearly as relaxed or comfortable. I have to confess that the significance of the little dancer's arm position eluded me for a long time. Having examined so many dance works by Degas and knowing something about his extreme deliberation in his work in general, it did not seem possible that the arm position was arbitrary. As he himself stated in a letter to a friend, "Nothing in art must seem to be chance, not even movement." In an attempt to understand the mechanics of this vexing and presumably meaningful arm position, I tried holding my arms in the same way. In doing so, I realized that it triggered the muscles involved in attaining proper balletic carriage. Was it possible Degas had represented an exercise that was no longer in use, or one that I simply had not encountered in my own training? Well, after meeting the eminent dance historian, Sandra Noel Hammond, I discovered that my suspicions were correct. Sandra herself had been taught an exercise that involved holding her arms in the same manner, and the purpose of the action was to stretch the back and relax the chest. As Sandra explained, holding the shoulders down with the hands clasped behind the back not only releases tension in the upper body, but it also encourages proper balletic carriage by engaging muscles that keep the chest open, meaning that the ribs are neither convex or concave. So you don't want to do this. You don't want to do that. You don't want to stick your chest down or pull it back. As I've argued elsewhere, the girl who posed for the little dancer, Marie van Gerten, was a highly suitable model for Degas' sculpture. She had long limbs, more than ample turnout, good posture, and a body suppleness that facilitates many balletic movements. But some of Degas' contemporaries vociferously objected to his choice of subject. In their eyes, she was an undernourished, half-dressed, and frightfully ugly girl whose figure embodied the supposed depravity of dancers. At this time, Paris opera dancers had a reputation for being promiscuous. Some were known to engage in intimate activities in exchange for gifts and financial support, and their affairs with opera patrons were openly pursued. Though this seems shocking today, more often than not, the young aspirants of Degas' time came from poor working-class families, and their low social status made them fair game for upper-class men. By the turn of the 19th century, a socially condoned system of clandestine prostitution had come into being at the Paris Opera, where wealthy male subscribers, the abonnés, were given free rein of the premises to court its performers. It's just outrageous. Despite this unwholesome environment, many opera ballerinas remained chaste. Surprise. But the stereotype of the dancer as seductress took hold. Perhaps not so surprisingly, this prejudice found expression in the reception of The Little Dancer, age 14, when it was first shown in 1881. The critic Paul Mons, for example, reported, "With bestial effrontery, the young dancer moves her face forward, or rather her little muzzle, and this word is completely appropriate because the poor girl has the makings of a rat." In this context, the word rat has multiple meanings. It referred to the model's dual status as a dancer in training, not only for an illustrious stage career, but also as an abonné's consort, and it referred to her base position on the evolutionary scale of human development. And a lot of people in the 19th century believed this. They believed if you were lower class, you were intellectually inferior. In all of these applications of the term rat, the low social standing of dancers, as well as their wantonness, is made very clear. The idealized figure of the ballet, you guess where I'm going? The idealized figure of a ballerina at left is what Degas' contemporaries were accustomed to, a demure, otherworldly being who hovers in arabesque as she flits across the stage. By the time this sculpture was made by Jean-Auguste Barre in 1861, the type was already a cliché, yet it continued to dominate the public's imagination until Degas' day. This romantic stereotype was constantly being undermined by the artist's pictures and sculptures, and The Little Dancer is arguably his most blatant challenge. In choosing Marie van Gerten as his model, Degas elected to represent a dancer who is clearly inexperienced, far from beautiful, disconcertingly skinny by contemporary standards, not to mention that she was stationary, not moving. In addition, there's a subtext to her thinness. It signaled poverty and hence her susceptibility to the advances of amorous abonnés and perhaps even more unsavory behavior. In effect, Degas was confronting his peers with evidence of the realities of dancers' working lives, much like his ruthlessly candid pictures of exhausted laundresses, humble milliners, and vulgar cabaret singers. All these factors contributed to the contemporary response to Degas' likeness of Marie van Gerten. Many critics were infuriated, and bourgeois art lovers were shocked. The Little Dancer, age 14, was a radical statement in the 19th century, and it remains one of the most radical works of art of all time. Thank you.
This has been the National Gallery of Art podcast.